Vrindiki Jai Namacharya Shilaharidas Thakur Ki Jai Premsikoho Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadha Shri Vasari Gaura Bhakta Vrindiki Jai Sri Sri Gaunitai Ki Jai Sri Sri Gaunitai Ki Jai Sri Sri Gaunitai Ki Jai Sankatan Jagi Ki Jai Nittai Go Pramanani Hari Hari Bo. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to all the devotees. All glories to CC Guru and Gauranga. Om Agyana Tamananda Shagananjana Salakaya Chakshush Unmalitam Jina Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha. Namaram Vishnu Varaya Krishna Vastaya Bhutale Srimati Tamal Krishna Goswamini Tanamane. Namaram Vishnu Varaya Krishna Vastaya Bhutale Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Swamini Tanamane. Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Pacharine Nevesesa Sunyavari Paschacha Desatarine. Vanchakopatrubhyascha Kripa Sindubhyavacha Paritanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha. Jaya Gora Bhakti Gana Gori Anaprana Sava Bhakti Mili Mori Bhakti Dehadana Hari Hari Bo. So we may not have the PowerPoint. Okay, we're not going to have it. That's fine. No, that's fine. I could do that, maybe. I don't know. No, that's fine. So today I wanted to share with you something about the culture of spiritual hospitality coming from India. And this culture of hospitality is based on a very, very important understanding of reality. And that is that we are all spiritually equal. We're all brothers and sisters ultimately. You see, in the world today, there's so much division. So much fighting is going on in the name of religion, racism, so much politics and fighting is going on. And at the core of these disputes is a misunderstanding that somehow or other we're separate from each other. But ultimately, we are all connected as spiritual brothers and sisters. And so this understanding of spiritual unity was fundamental to the culture of spiritual hospitality. You see, there's a difference between hospitality that you have experienced, that you normally experience, when, say, for example, you go to a party or you go to a restaurant where the emphasis is on more about the presentation, the prestige, you know, how someone is presenting themselves, how they're presenting the food. It's very external. And in many cases, usually the host is more concerned about what other people are thinking of them as they're serving. Their motivation is, will people like me if I serve them nicely? Whereas in spiritual hospitality, the understanding is, you are my brother, you are my sister. Let me serve you, I love you. Let me feed you. It's very unconditional. The mood is of service. Let me serve you without any conditions, without any motivation to get something back from you. So Srila Prabhupada, the founder of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, He brought the spiritual hospitality culture to the Western world, all over the world. And he introduced it in a very humble way. When he started his first temple in New York in 1966, he was providing... He's doing kirtan, giving Bhagavad Gita lectures, giving people spiritual knowledge. But after every lecture, he would take one apple, cut the apple into small pieces, and give everyone a little taste of an apple. And you may think, well, that doesn't seem to be very hospitable. You know, then he's not serving them a feast. Of course, at the time, he didn't have the money to provide a feast for his guests. So he just gave them one little piece of apple. But of course, that apple was offered to the Lord with love. He asked Krishna, please you taste this apple first. And so in his mind, he felt this was not an ordinary apple anymore. This apple now had was surcharged with spiritual energy. So therefore, if people just took one mouthful, they would nourish their spirit as well. So I often quote this example to members of our community to emphasize how important prasadam distribution is in this Krishna consciousness movement. The fact that Srila Prabhupada would take one apple and give people a small piece of that apple, because that's all he could afford, that shows how important he felt it was to give people the experience of spiritual food. Okay? So in 1974, I don't know if we're going to have a PowerPoint presentation or not. You think we will? Maybe? Okay, then I can tell you other things. In 1974, Swami Prabhupada was looking out of his window of his room, and he saw children fighting with dogs over scraps of food. Traditionally in India, people eat off leaf plates, right? Right? Banana leaf plate, and then they chuck the leaf plate behind the house, behind the temple. And then it decomposes, the dogs come and eat, the pigs come and eat. But in this particular occasion, he noticed children pushing the dogs away, trying to get the scraps of food. And he thought, oh my God, this is terrible. No one should be hungry where there's a temple. God is the Father, and no children should go hungry. So he called his students, he called all the devotees, and he says, you see this? We should not allow this to happen. No one within 10-mile radius of our temples should ever go hungry. And so from that point on, the devotees began serving prasadam regularly every day so that no one was hungry in the region. And that essentially became, that was like the beginning of ISKCON's major distribution of prasadam, spiritual food. And the program then expanded into the Western world, and eventually the Krishna devotees formalized the program. It became known as Hare Krishna Food for Life. They had vans and they had restaurants and they had all different ways of distributing this nice food. And to now, 2013, which is what, how long ago is that? Nearly 40 years, 39 years. We have distributed many billions of meals and currently serving up to 3 million meals a day. 3 million meals a day. That's about 40 meals a second. So every second, 40 meals are going out around the world. And these are freshly prepared meals. This is not packaged meals. It's not something you buy from the supermarket and distribute. This is freshly prepared that morning. Here's your plate of food. We love you. Meals. Beautiful. It's amazing. It's the biggest. We're not only the biggest vegetarian food relief in the world, we're actually the biggest food relief in the world. Even the United Nations does not distribute as much food as we do. The United Nations World Food Program distributes about 90 million meals a year, prepared meals a year. Hare Krishna Food for Life and all of the affiliates around the world distribute that in about 3 months, that amount in about 3 months. So we're actually doing more than the United Nations World Food Program. Another wonderful thing about this program is the efficiency that it operates. On average, a meal only costs around 10 to 20 cents. So that means for every dollar that people donate, that a person donates, we can feed between 5 and 10 people, which is unheard of in the industry. No one can serve as many meals as we can. And why is that so? It's because most of the people involved are volunteers. Vegetarian food is obviously cheaper than meat-based food. And the way we prepare the meals is a very efficient efficient method. Often we do Indian type of meals, Indian style cooking, and that's very a very efficient way of feeding lots of people. So in this way, the program is expanding and expanding and expanding. Now, an important thing to understand about this is that Food for Life is not actually a hunger relief organization. That is not our agenda. Is that the projector? Oh, very good. Well, it's on a... Do you know how to do that? Food for Life is not a hunger relief organization. We are an organization that is, our focus is creating unity in the world, peace and unity. Swami Prabhupada said in a comment one time, he said, by the liberal distribution of prasadam, which is pure food, blessed food, and sankirtan, the whole world can become peaceful and prosperous. So that actually became our mission at Food for Life. We use food as a medium to express our love to the world, and by doing this, we help to create unity in the world. So our focus is creating unity, and our preferred method is using food. The fact that we feed the hungry people, that's just a consequence. The fact that we're the world's largest food relief, that's just, you know, that's wonderful, but that's not our agenda. Our agenda is creating unity in the world. So world hunger is a big problem, and we're going to have to coordinate the changing of the slides. So you have to hit the down button. Maybe if you can turn around to me and I can see what's coming. Can you come up closer to me?
No, it's not.
You stuck there? Okay. All right. This is actually... go back. Go to the next one. This is the... Want me to do that? Okay, fine. I will do that. It's more interesting, and now you can see pictures. Okay? I wasn't very animated because we played soccer for 2 hours today, so... Okay. So I'm a bit tired. So a solution to world hunger and a peaceful world. This is actually the quote from Swami Prabhupada. He said, the Krishna consciousness movement, it's a cultural movement. It's not a religion, actually. It's a cultural movement, a spiritual culture. He said it's based on chanting the Maha Mantra at every moment as much as possible, inside and outside the temples, and as far as possible distributing prasad. That's really what the movement is based on. Everything else is supporting that. And then in the next sentence, he gives a clue, a strategy, how we can actually effectively do that. He says if we can accelerate this, if we get the help of the government and the wealthy people. And this is especially where Food for Life plays an important role. Because as Food for Life, we present ourselves not as some religious organization, but we present ourselves as part of the community contributing positively for the benefit of everyone. And by doing this, the government officials are very happy to work with us. The wealthy people are very happy to work with us. And then therefore we can expand the program. And then in the last sentence, he gives the benediction, basically. He says, by the liberal distribution of prasad, blessed food, and sankirtan, which is chanting, the whole world can become peaceful and prosperous. So that's a very beautiful comment in the Srimad Bhagavatam. Here's another comment. And he said, everyone should get a chance to take prasad and thus be encouraged to chant the holy name and dance in ecstasy. By these three processes, although performed without knowledge, even without knowledge, even a dog went back to Godhead. So this is a commentary on a story, a very famous story, where a dog came into the company of Krishna devotees, and rather than pushing the dog away, they welcomed the dog in the pilgrimage. And in fact, the gentleman who was heading up the pilgrimage,
he arranged for cooks to prepare special meals for the dog. This is real compassion. This is real spiritual understanding. He said, you make special boiled rice for this dog, so the dog gets a proper meal. So he treated the dog just like one of the other humans that were on the pilgrimage. And then the story goes that dog actually passed away, and the conclusion was that dog actually was liberated because it got the blessed food. So hunger is a big problem in the world today. More than 1 billion people in the world, 1 billion, right, live in poverty. That means they're living on less than $1 a day. Imagine a 1 euro a day. That's their income. Not very much. You couldn't do much with that, right? Imagine living in Slovenia on 1 euro a day. Very difficult. Okay. Some people can do it. So 864 million people are malnourished. That means they're not getting, there's a certain quota of nourishment that our body requires, and these people are not reaching that quota. So they may be getting food, but the food is not nourishing. Okay? That's a big problem. 864 million people. The worst affected are children. Between 40 and 60 million people die every year from hunger-related diseases. But of those 40 to 60, 12 to 15 million are children under the age of 5. 12 to 15 million children under the age of 5 die every year from hunger-related diseases. Now, to put that in perspective, you think, okay, that's a big number. But to put it in perspective, that's the same as 100 plane crashes every day. Imagine if there were 100 plane crashes every day. That's the equivalent of how many children are dying every day from hunger-related diseases. And that should not happen, but it's happening right now. So we need to demonstrate our compassion, right? There's a quote from Prabhupada, another quote, very nice one. He says that the priests of society, they are generally unaware of the happenings within the mature world because they are always busy in their activities for spiritual advancement. Nonetheless, when there is calamity in human society, they cannot remain impartial. If they do not do something to relieve the distressed condition, it is said that due to such neglect, their spiritual knowledge diminishes. So it's important for us to demonstrate our compassion, actually do something about it. And the beautiful thing is, with prasadam, we can demonstrate our compassion for them physically and spiritually. So in 1996, the World Food Program, they had a conference, and they have many of these conferences, but in 1996 there was a special conference, and the theme of the conference was hunger in a world of plenty. So it was a question they were asking, how is there hunger in the world when there's so much food? It was a very important question. And what they concluded was, the problem is not insufficient food, but inequitable distribution. The food is not being shared. There's plenty of food. Plenty of food. In fact, the earth has the capacity to make enough food for twice the population. 14 billion people. There's so much land that's not even being used. There's something like in Australia, in many places around the world, there's just unused land that could be growing crops and so on. Not only that, in a small patch of area, maybe about 10 by 10, no, not even that, maybe by 3 by 10, very small patch of land, you can grow enough vegetables for a family of 6. It's very easy to do that. So greed is the cause. That's the cause of world hunger, is greed. There's plenty of food, but people are not sharing it. Right? You have countries like America having surplus milk, surplus wheat, surplus rice and so on, and they're dumping it in the ocean in order to maintain the market price rather than sharing it with their brothers and sisters in Africa or India. You see? So greed is the cause. So why would there be greed? Why would there be greed? Why would people have that mentality? They have that mentality because this consumer culture that is present around the world, it's all about me, 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 me. What's good for me? I'm the only one that really matters. you know, I'm the center of this universe. That's the mentality that people have today. Rather than seeing themselves as a flower in a garden of flowers, we're all brothers and sisters. So in the Vedas, there's a quote from the Ishopanishad. One should accept only those things necessary for themselves as their quota. Everyone has a quota and should not accept other things knowing well to whom they belong. You come into this world empty-handed. You leave this world empty-handed, right? You come in the world naked with no money, nothing, and you leave the same way. So what do we actually own? Everything that comes to us has been a blessing of someone else and ultimately a blessing of God. So with that understanding, we should be so careful about the things that come to us, so respectful, and share them accordingly. So if we have this sort of understanding, equal vision, this greed mentality goes away. The humble sage, the wise man, the wise woman, by virtue of true knowledge, they see equally. A priest, a cow, an elephant, a dog eater, a rich man, a poor man, a cat, elephant, rhinoceros, bird, they don't distinguish. That's simply a material vehicle. Ultimately, we're all spiritually equal. So spiritual quality of all beings, as I mentioned earlier, is at the heart of the food for life philosophy, a prasadam culture. The Vedas also talk about controlling the tongue, right? Spirituality begins with the tongue. This is a very interesting statement, because when people hear this, they're like, what? Right? It's like, that doesn't make sense. Spirituality begins with the tongue, because you have to control the tongue. The tongue can be our worst enemy. It can say horrible things, or it can say very sweet things. It can eat horrible things, or it can eat very nice things. It can eat violence, or it can eat peace and love. So the tongue is very, very important. It is, according to the yoga tradition, it is the most important sense to control. When you control the tongue, you control all the other senses. It's a key. It's a key to success in yoga. So as you can see, these gentlemen here, one is eating very voraciously and eating anything, and they become a pig in the next life, and the other is eating lots of meat. And so the next body for them, which is very appropriate, is to get a tiger's body, because that body is perfectly designed for eating meat. So your wishes are fulfilled. You can do whatever you want. You have free will. If you want to be a tiger, you want to be a pig, no problem. So karma is also a very important part of the Bhagavad Gita philosophy. As you sow, so shall you reap. This is a very famous picture in the Krishna movement. The man, the cow has come back with a man's head to kill the man with his cow body. So this is an important principle within the spiritual hospitality culture. It's called Atithi Narayan, and I actually learnt this from Sridhar Swami. He's one of my Food for Life mentors. I'd never heard of this before, but I'd heard it from him. And he said there's a principle in Vedic culture that when someone comes to your house unexpected, they just knock on the door, you don't expect them, you should treat them like God, right? The unexpected guest, that's the mentality. What to speak of your friends, your family, the people that you actually invite to your home. So you should treat them like God. So that the culture is such that if someone comes to your house, the very least you give them a seat. If you can, give them water. And best is give them a seat, water and a meal. This is the culture. All right? So Atithi Narayan means treat the unexpected guest like God. But people love eating meat, right? Getting back to that other slide. Why is it so that people like eating meat? Right? Even people know that it's not good for them. They know that they're eating violence. They know that it's, you know, not healthy for them. There's so much scientific data, so much research has been done. But people like to eat meat. And so it's a problem. So what do we do with that? Well, according to the Bhagavad Gita, the way to give up the lower taste is to experience a higher taste. If you experience a higher taste, for example, when you're a little girl or a little boy, you like to eat gummy bears or lollipops or something like that, right? Candy canes. But now you're not really interested in that. Your tastes have improved. You've experienced higher taste now. Now you're more interested in some maybe, you know, cakes or something. So the food yoga solution, this is something that I've been developing over many, many years. I wrote this book called Food Yoga, right? And the idea behind this book was to teach people about prasadam culture, teach people about spiritual hospitality, how to nourish their body, mind, and spirit. Because most of the emphasis these days, particularly from people teaching healthy lifestyle, is all about the body. Oh, you've got to eat this food. You've got to have this superfood because it's got magnesium. You've got to have this food because it's high in calcium and so on. That's all nice, but what about the spirit? What about the mind, right? So we have to nourish our body, mind, and spirit. So food yoga is the art of uniting mind, body, spirit, so they work as one. And it also the art of connecting ultimately with the Supreme Spirit using food. Yoga is not becoming a pretzel, right? I don't know how he did that, but it's pretty far out. It's pretty amazing, right? So that's not yoga. Just doing asanas. That's a very small part of yoga. Yoga is about connecting with your spirit, connecting with your source. And when you do the asanas, that's just like the beginning stage where you honor your body as a temple. You respect your body as a temple and you treat it properly. You do stressless exercises. You oxygenate it, get the oxygen flowing, get everything like nicely running, efficiently running. And you feed it pure food so that the temple is always clean. In this way, this is the beginning stage of yoga. And it prepares you for meditation. So in the quantum string theory, this is an interesting part of the food yoga philosophy. Because in order to teach people about prasadam, I realized I needed to first convince them that eating prasadam was a good thing to do. Because if, as followers of the Krishna movement, we automatically believe in prasadam. We know, oh yes, eat prasadam, it's good for you, it's spiritual food. But for the average person, it doesn't mean anything to them. So I felt like I needed to convince them scientifically that this food that we're calling prasadam is not ordinary food. It has physically been changed. It's not the same anymore. It's not simply faith. Physically it has changed, all right? So according to quantum string theory, essentially everything is just vibration. Everything is just a wave, a vibration, a frequency. Everything. This table, this cup, everything is simply vibrating energy. And what we call matter, solid matter, is really just compressed energy. But ultimately everything is energy and it's operating at different frequencies, different vibrations. And according to the magical, you know, properties of material creation, these energies appear as different things and different people and different voices and different colors, but it's ultimately just energy, right? So food is also compressed energy, right? Food is also just energy. Yes, it may be apples and bananas and peppers and tomatoes, but that's really, in another sense, it's really just energy transformed into something else. Our bodies are nature. The same energy that is making stars and planets is the same energy that's making our bodies. We are made of the same thing that stars and planets are made of. Think about that. The same energy that the stars and planets are made of, we are made of those same things. No different. Just different combinations. Right? All energy. Thoughts are also energy. Your thought. When you have a thought, right now you have this energy flowing around you, electrical energy, flowing around, just like a torus shape. It flows from the head around like this as the energy. Just like the earth has this electromagnetic energy around it, the earth is like a magnet. We're also magnets and we have this energy flow. So your thoughts are also there. And this is how sometimes we can pick up on people's moods just by being near them. They don't have to say anything, but we can tell. We sense that there's something wrong. Because the energy, the thoughts are flowing around them. They're not hidden inside their body magically. They're all around them. So messages within water. This is an interesting thing I found about 10 years ago or so. A Japanese doctor, he did some study on how water is affected by what it is exposed to. And I guess he got this inspiration from the science of homeopathy. Now, when you have a homeopathic remedy, right? Who's had homeopathic remedies before? Has anyone had homeopathic remedies? Right? You've had? So essentially, homeopathic remedies is just water. It's just water. That water has been exposed or touched by something, a bacteria, a flower, a herb, or something. And then they dilute that physical thing out of the water. So what remains is just water, but the water has a signature. It has the energy still of that thing. And so you take that homeopathic remedy and magically you're cured. So water remembers what it's touched by. And that's what he wanted to prove this. So he traveled around the world and he took water samples from different places around the world and then froze the water and looked at the crystal structure. And what he noticed is on the left-hand side, you see a mountain spring in Japan. The water crystal is very symmetrical, very beautiful, like a flower. And on the right-hand side at the top, this is water from a dirty river in Japan. And similarly, you see a glacier in New Zealand. Lourdes, France, the healing waters of the Lourdes in France. And so he thought, well, that's very interesting, but also very logical. Obviously, water from the spring is going to be nice and pure. So then he thought, what if I take water from the same source and expose it to different energies? So he took water from, say, a municipal tap or a river, and then he took one glass of water and exposed it to negative sound vibration. I hate you. I want to kill you. You're ugly. Whatever. And in the other water, the same source, he exposed it to positive sound. I love you. Thank you. These are the most powerful words. According to his research, the most powerful phrases are I love you and thank you. And then he exposed the water to that. And then he froze the water and he looked at the crystal structure. And he noticed that the water that was exposed to pure sound was very symmetrical, just like the ones up the top. And the water exposed to negative sound was shattered, like the one on the right-hand side, heavy metal music. Right? Right? Interesting, huh? So it's essentially what Dr. Emoto was proving is that your thoughts are energy, sound is another form of energy, and when water is exposed to those energies, it physically changes. It's not the same anymore, okay? Well, consider this. The food that we eat is mostly water. You have an apple or an orange. An apple's probably 90% water. An orange is probably 95% water. So don't you think that that orange, if it's exposed to negative energy, is going to contain that, is going to contain that same negative energy in it when you eat it? Certainly it will. So this is scientific proof that, yeah, the tongue. That's a real tongue. This is scientific proof. Yeah, it's a real tongue. Right? Scientific proof that food physically changes when it's exposed to certain energies. Oh. So we have to control the tongue in order to control the other senses. And as I mentioned before, the body is like a temple. We're human beings, we're spiritual beings, sorry, and we're having a human experience. But this gentleman here, the doctor, he goes to the doctor, and the doctor thinks, well, it doesn't look like your body is really a temple. It's more like an amusement arcade, like Disneyland. Right? So there's a problem today. You see around the world there's so much obesity. Obesity is actually the biggest, it's in epidemic proportions now. Like, I can't remember the percentage though, but it's a very large percentage now of the population is overweight. And of course, overweight also results in many, many diseases and poor health. So how to control the tongue? The tongue has two functions. Tasting, eating only pure foods that are devoid of violence and fear. So this gets back to this idea that food is remembering, because of its water content, is getting affected by the energies it's exposed to. All right? So eating only foods that have a pure source. It's prepared, it's grown and prepared with pure energy and with pure thoughts. And vibrating, speaking words that are truthful, pleasing, beneficial, not agitating, as well as chanting mantras. So often when we think about this principle of vibrating, we focus on just chanting. But actually, purifying the tongue also means to speak the truth, to speak words that are uplifting, beneficial to others. That's also another austerity of the tongue. So food is a great uniter, and this is what I touched upon early on, right? It is used at spiritual festivals. What sort of festival would it be if there was no food served, right? Even today, how many of you would honestly come today if there was no Sunday feast, right? Honestly? Maybe a few. You like chanting too. That's good. But if there was no Sunday feast, you'd probably have a little bit hesitation. You think, oh, you know, there's no food, so therefore maybe I'll just do kirtan at home. All right? That's the reality, if you're honest. So food is central to every culture, spiritual festivals, family celebrations, business meetings. What business meeting takes place without food? There's always something. Some food is shared. Food is a transporter of love. That's why. And in every culture, it's central. If I ask you, tell me something about Italy. Tell me something about Italy. Pizza. Right? Tell me something about Ukrainian culture. Borscht. Oh, no, right? Borscht? Yes? Right? But it's always food. Food is the center of every culture. It's like the hub of the wheel, right? And every aspect of that culture is connected to it by like spokes of a wheel, right? Jai Sisi Ganitai. So I believe that because it's central to every culture, food can solve all problems. And as I talked about before, world hunger is a big problem, right? Right? But it's not simply about distributing food. Distributing lots of food doesn't solve world hunger. It's addressing the core problem, which is greed. And greed comes from not understanding our spiritual equality. So when we share food with everyone, when we share food with others, we're acknowledging, you're my brother, I love you, you're my sister, I love you, let's share food. We're all one family. Imagine if the world had this mentality, all problems would go away. Everything. There'd be no problem in the world. So this Food for Life program is much more than probably you first realized. You probably thought, oh, you know, it's a nice charity program. No, it has a very deep, deep, deep philosophy. So this is a little bit about what we're doing around the world, all right? So the program started, as I said, in around 1974. And this is the type of big woks we used to use. That wok is so big, you could probably have about 8 people in there having a bath. Right? If you put hot water in there, you could have maybe 8 people, big hot tub. Right, big cooking pots. Prabhupada said, no one should go hungry. This is the scope of our, it's actually more than 2 million meals a day now. All of those yellow dots around the world are Food for Life projects. Prasadam distribution is going on. Okay? It's very, very vast. This is our mission statement. To bring about peace and prosperity in the world through the liberal distribution of pure food prepared with love. That's our mission statement. Uniting the world through pure food, that's our marketing message. Uniting the world through pure food. That's really is our focus. So we have many different programs. We have budget cafes where basically people pay a small amount of money and they can eat as much as they want. We do emergency relief. We do home delivery. Deliver to shelters like they're doing here in Slovenia, in Ljubljana. We distribute food at schools, at orphanages. This is an example of Food for Life restaurant in Moscow. And our target group there is elderly women. So we have different programs for different locations. This is a budget cafe in Australia where people can eat as much as they want for a set price. This is tsunami relief. The tsunami of 2004, 2005. Food for Life actually was the first responder to that relief. The same afternoon the tsunami hit, you remember the tsunami hitting in Indonesia? The same afternoon, Food for Life was serving prasadam in Chennai. It was actually a Sunday, and they were preparing the Sunday feast. And then the tsunami hit, and they thought, oh, forget the Sunday feast, let's take this food to the beach. And immediately they started feeding people that afternoon. We were the first responder out of anyone in the world. And of course, we went on and we distributed hundreds of thousands of meals in Sri Lanka. We focused on Sri Lanka because that was the most practical for us. This is how we served food in Sri Lanka. We cooked on firewood in the villages. We had volunteers from all over the world, from Hungary, from Slovenia, from Russia, Australia, of course, me, United States. We had about 50 to 80 volunteers. And we set up kitchens around the island and we served people freshly cooked meals every day. They were very happy. And of course the women were actually, the Sri Lankan people love chilies. So the village women would tell us how to make the food. They would say, more chili. More tomato. More chili now. Like this. And so they were actually instructing us what to do. And then we had all the children cutting the vegetables. And I told the children, I says, look, if you help us cut up, because we had to prepare a lot of meals, everyone gets a t-shirt. So then they put their hands up. So then we had give t-shirts to all the children and everyone's chopping up every day. So they were very happy. Not only were they getting prasadam, but they were doing service. So this is the wonderful thing about this program is we can engage anybody in devotional service. There's no limit. It's always relevant. Prasadam is always relevant every time, every place, every circumstance. Because it's the center of everyone's consciousness, it's the center of every culture. This is an example of food relief in Poland. And at that particular occasion, we served sandwiches and soup. This is an important point. We don't have to cook Indian food. We cook according to local taste, whatever's practical, right? I always tell the devotees this as I travel, even for the temple. Prabhupada encourages us to cook according to local taste. So we can make borscht. We can make whatever's popular and vegetarian in this country. Krishna is not Indian. So we can make, you know, whatever's pleasing to him, whatever's pleasing to the culture. Food relief, flood relief in Mozambique. This particular occasion, we were serving a type of porridge because that's what people like to eat there. And they're very happy to get their meal in the flood. This is food relief in the war in Chechnya. In 1994, 95, and I took this photo. I was there and helping for a couple of weeks, and we had volunteers from Russia primarily, and they stayed there for 2 years. During the war, Food for Life was the only relief agency in Chechnya, in Grozny. All the other, even the Red Cross, they wouldn't come into the city. It was so dangerous. But Food for Life was based right in the city, working out of an abandoned school, every day feeding people, thousands of meals. making them hot, like vegetable curry, tea, and freshly baked bread. They made bread every day. And they did that for 2 years. Under great stress, under great, great danger. One time they were actually situated right in front of the Russian base, right? And at that particular time, the Russians had taken control of the city. And then the Chechen warriors, they came in and they started attacking. And they happened to come right across, right in front of the kitchen. So they were, of course, they were working out of a school. There was a courtyard, right? So the fighting's going on right in the courtyard, right, while they're in the kitchen. They're lying on the floor. Bullets are flying through the windows, right? This is the danger that they had. They had to face every day, fighting all around them while they're trying to feed the people. Yeah, and unfortunately, one of the volunteers was killed. One time he was distributing food to the hospital, and then the Russians came in and bombed the hospital, if you can imagine, and the shrapnel cut his leg, and he died of blood loss. Unfortunately, but all the local people glorified him. They had a special ceremony for him because he was one of the heroes in their eyes. He was one of the local heroes. So this is Grozny, and these are the volunteers. And I visited them. I'm in the middle there, and I visited them for 2 weeks. And all of these boys and girls, they were there for 2 years, feeding people. It was an amazing project. This was the only real decent meal in the city. This is another example of Food for Life in Sarajevo. This is Food for Life in after the Katrina hurricanes in New Orleans, when the whole city was flooded. The whole city was flooded. You may have seen the pictures. And we fed them organic vegan meals. This is other examples of Food for Life in different countries. Yeah, yeah. This is in Delhi. This is in Ecuador. So different styles of serving prasadam. This is in Philippines. This is in Poland, I believe. This is in Fiji. They like rice there, right? This is a tsunami in Japan. And Food for Life again was there. Food for Life Global was there again feeding people. This is how people, the refugees, were living in basketball courts. They lost everything. Everything was gone. So then they gathered in these auditoriums, and all of these things that you see have all been donated. Clothing, you know, whatever. But they're living here. They're sleeping on the floor for many, many months. They lost everything, and they were very happy to receive prasadam. Very, very happy. This is how they were, you know, living every day. So in this way, not only are we feeding people, nourishing their body, but we're nourishing their spirit. Could you imagine how people feel when you come to them with a plate of food in this situation? They fall in love with you. You are their friend forever. You're nourishing their spirit, and they know that, and they'll never forget you. This is the power of food. And imagine, you know, food has this power. What to speak of prasadam? Because it's not only food, it's pure food. This is again in Japan. This is our school in Vrindavan, Food for Life Vrindavan. It's the best Food for Life program in India. This is where the children come from. We take children from the slums of India in Vrindavan. This is their home. You're looking at someone's home right now. They live in these little houses made of sticks and blankets and whatever they can find. That's where we take these children, and we bring them in Rupa Raghunath, the director. He brings them into the school. He educates them. Oh, this is a horrible picture. He educates them, feeds them until they've graduated out of school, high school. This little girl was abandoned. The mother walked away from her. Rupa found her like this. She has flies all over her face, and she doesn't even realize how bad that is. She thinks that's normal. Mother just walked away from her. And so he took that child in, and he clothed her, he bathed her, and he's now educating her, and she's now a very happy student. And you can see the transformation of these children. They're glowing, they're happy, they're alive, they're getting loved. And so the wonderful thing about Rupa's program is not only is he feeding people, but he's providing other services so that these people have full opportunity in life. So it's very nice. And every day they're chanting, every day there's spiritual practices so that the children get complete nourishment of mind, body and spirit. They eat off stainless steel plates and they eat like queens and kings. Right? Remember, these children come from the slum. These are not rich children. They look for like normal kids in India. These are the poorest children in India being cared for. This is our premier programs in India, and it's called the Anamrita program. And these are the kitchens we have. These are stainless steel pressure cookers, steam cookers. This one kitchen makes enough meals for 65,000 people a day. Every day, 65,000. They start at like 2 in the morning preparing the vegetables, and they finish about 9 to 10 o'clock in the morning. So it's about 8-hour shift. And they go out, they distribute, they put the, this is the preparation going on, and then they put them in trucks. See those stainless steel containers on the left? They load the trucks, they load the vans, and they travel, these hundreds of these vans travel all over India and dropping off meals at schools. This is another one of the trucks. Look, donate rupees 700. What is rupees 700 in euro, approximately? $10? For 10 euro, you can feed a kid for the whole year. How good is that? Right? That's efficiency. And the only way we can do that is because most of the people involved are volunteers. The administration costs are very, very low, on average about 10%, 20% max. Rupa Raghunath, the school that you saw, he operates at about 6 to 8% administration. That's unheard of around the world. Red Cross is like 60 to 70% or more. So this is how we're able to feed so many children, because we keep administration costs low, mostly volunteers. It's a beautiful, beautiful project. This is Food for Life in, this is actually the Food for Life in Delhi area. And the children are getting, this is another project in West Bengal. This devotee Mahashringa, he's one of the best examples of prasadam distribution in the world. He's such a wonderful person, dedicated his life to distributing prasadam, feeding people. He's like a hero to the villagers in West Bengal. They honor him like their guru. He's so much loved by them because for years and years and years he's been feeding them. This is Food for Life in the Philippines. And they do, in this particular situation, they do kirtan because it's appropriate. People don't, you know, people appreciate the kirtan. But it's not always necessary. This is Food for Life Eco Village. It's an eco village based in the Congo, which is 100% self-sufficient. Largest rice producers. 91 crops, 100% recycling, all vegetarian, no hunger, no unemployment. So this is a part of the Food for Life Global Network. Food for Life Global is the headquarters for Food for Life. And we have a network of affiliates that are not only distributing prasadam, but are also supporting the prasadam culture. And this is an example of supporting prasadam culture, where we're showing people how to live in harmony with nature. This is an orphanage in Sri Lanka. It's like a private school. These orphans come from the war. They come from the tsunami. And yet they have 3 meals a day, full education, medical care, yoga and meditation, classical music, classical dance. They're so happy. This is like a private school. Look, the boy's doing yoga every day. The girl's doing dance every day. These are orphans. And of course, it's all free. People come; these children come, and they get it's such a beautiful experience. They grow up like this in this beautiful situation. This is the organizer, the director. Her name escapes me right now, but she's known as Amma, which means mother. And many people have glorified Food for Life, and one of the most prominent people that have praised Food for Life is Nelson Mandela. And he understood that Food for Life was not simply a food relief program, but it was all about nourishing spirit and creating unity in the world. He understood that. It was very nice. This is a very famous newspaper article that appeared in the New York Times. And the reporter says, Food for Life volunteers have a reputation like Mother Teresa has in Calcutta. It's not hard finding someone to swear they are saints. This was actually a Muslim country. This is a Muslim country. And the fact that these Muslim people literally were bowing down to the Hindu monks was very astonishing. And he was very surprised. And he says, people treat them like saints. So this is how you can get involved in Food for Life. You can volunteer. You volunteer locally. You can volunteer internationally. You can become an advocate. Just tell people about Food for Life. You could promote it on the internet through the social networks. You can tell the media. Tell your friends. Raise awareness for us. This is the Food for Life website, the principal website, and we report on what's going on around the world. And this is a 5-minute video, if it'll come up. There it is. I think. Just a little bit about Food for Life. This is a little dated, it's a little old, but you still get an idea of what's going on. I think it's going to go. And we'll finish there. It's going to go. It's not going to work? May not work. Okay. It may not work. Okay. I won't do it. So that's our website. Food Yogi is, this is the book, Food Yoga. And you can, I have copies today if you want a copy. I'll sign them. And you can also go to foodyoga.org to learn about prasadam culture. And you can go to FFL.org to get involved with the charity. Thank you very much. That's all. If anyone has any questions or comments, I know I wanted to say something very important. I wanted to thank all the volunteers in Ljubljana who've been doing a wonderful service. Your example has been noted, and you know I really appreciate what you're doing. And especially, we want to thank Lalita Govinda Prabhu, Bhavananda Roy Prabhu, Sundari Mataji, Tara Lakshi Mataji, Daras Bezjak, Ananda Vardhana Prabhu, Ananta Prabhu, Pushta Nittai Prabhu, and of course many, many others. We want to thank you and give you a round of applause and appreciate all the wonderful service you're doing. Does anyone have any questions or comments? Are you shocked? Are you still taking it all in?
Hare Krishna.
One question. Можно глаз?
If there are many countries around the world where people have a lot of kids, and if this food can help them with their lusty desires, because they have so many kids, they cannot feed them. So, this is the question.
If help them with their lusty desires? It's an unusual question. You're kidding. Sometimes people are having children because in order to help, basically help the family. You know, like it's not right that, you know, that there's a principle that you should not become a father or a mother or a guru if you can't deliver your dependents, if you can't save them, if you can't help them. It's a big responsibility to be a parent. And it should not be taken lightly, because there are too many neglected children in the world. There are so many homeless children, so many children that they're living in a home, but they don't feel like they're home. They have mothers and fathers, but they don't feel loved. So it's a big responsibility. Prasadam definitely can help, because prasadam purifies the consciousness. And when you eat prasadam, you're not just nourishing your body, you're cleansing your mind and you're nourishing your spirit with love. And it's this love heals all. And when your heart is filled with love, you see spiritual equality. Your natural behavior is to want to serve, to want to help someone, and not simply exploit them. That's really the essence of love. Love is unconditional service. That's love. Love is not, you know, what can you give to me to make me feel good? That's not love. Love is, how can I make you feel fantastic? How can I make you just be so happy? And without any conditions. So that's real love. It's unconditional service. And that's why bhakti yoga is so beautiful, because it's all about developing our unconditional service attitude. So if you have this understanding, then you would take your role as you'd act responsibly.
Hare Krishna. Hvala.